funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role has Ben Bernanke played in the apparent economic recovery? And does he bear some responsibility for the near collapse of the financial system in the first place? President Obama this week expressed his confidence in the Federal Reserve chairman by extending him another four-year contract that will begin in January when Bernanke's current term ends. So far, financial analysts and financial markets seem to be reacting positively to the news that this unconventional leader will remain at the helm of the Fed. Here to discuss Bernanke's unprecedented actions and what led him to them is David Wessel. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning economics editor of The Wall Street Journal and the author of In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Starting with his academic career, Ben Bernanke has been consumed with studying the causes and the impact of the Great Depression. Can you talk about how that focus has shaped him ultimately as a policymaker?
Sure. Ben Bernanke was an early student of the work that Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz did. They reported with great detail that the Fed had essentially created the Great Depression out of a really deep recession by being too tight with money. And he elaborated on that work, looking at the important role that bank failures played in propagating the Great Depression. They had said the bank failures were a result of tight money. He said, no, it's more than that. They made things worse. So this was a little bit like a paleontologist who studied dinosaurs. It was very interesting, but it didn't seem terribly relevant. Then he gets to be chairman of the Fed, and suddenly we have a whole bunch of Tyrannosaurus Rex on the horizon, and this insight becomes extraordinarily relevant. At first, some people thought he was overdoing it. They thought he was seeing something that wasn't there. But as the crisis evolved, it became quite clear that this was the right metaphor, and that's the one that led him to do whatever it took to get us out of the risk of another Great Depression.
Yeah, let's talk for a minute about his history with the Fed, because, in fact, his chairmanship represents his second tenure there. Can you talk about the influence he had on the actions of Alan Greenspan when he was chairman?
Yeah, Ben Bernanke was a very influential member of Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan's board, particularly when Mr. Greenspan cut interest rates and held them low for a long time. Mr. Bernanke provided some of the academic or intellectual foundation for that, arguing that Japan had gotten into trouble because it didn't take the risk of deflation or falling prices seriously enough. And so he stood behind Mr. Greenspan as he ran a policy that, with the benefit of hindsight, it looks like was too rates too low for too long and led to an orgy of speculation and borrowing. In addition, Mr. Bernanke was, like Mr. Greenspan, a proponent of the view that the Fed shouldn't try and pop asset bubbles. When stock prices or house prices are going up, there really wasn't much the Fed could do about it. They should just be prepared to pick up the pieces if the bubble burst. But he did in one speech suggest that, well, maybe the Fed shouldn't raise interest rates to burst an asset bubble, but it should be prepared to use its regulatory muscle. Well, he said that, but there's no evidence that he did anything about it. And I think in retrospect, that was also a mistake.
Did Greenspan have a great deal of influence on Bernanke's actions once he became chairman?
I don't think so. I think that Mr. Greenspan has been an active analyst of the economy, continues to speak through the press and to his private clients. And I'm sure Mr. Bernanke hears what he says. Where I think the interesting situation is that when Mr. Bernanke took office in February 2006, he said he wanted to follow Alan Greenspan's policies, but he said he wanted to have a style very different than Mr. Greenspan. He wanted to be the un-Greenspan. He thought Greenspan had made the Fed too much like the Vatican, with an infallible pope at the top and everybody else was anonymous, and he wanted to elevate the institution and the other members of the Fed's policy committee, and he tried that for about a year. But when the crisis came along, he realized there's a reason that committees have chairmen. He became much more prominent. And then in recent months, he went well beyond anything Greenspan did. He's gone on TV to basically make the case that the Fed is your best friend in Washington.
Yeah, it's been really interesting that he's often described as sort of reticent, and yet he has been much more public in some ways, even than Greenspan was during his tenure.
Right. I think that that reflects both a philosophy and the circumstances. The philosophy is quite different than Mr. Greenspan. Mr. Greenspan really believed that the Fed worked best when nobody really quite knew what they were doing, because if he was too open about what his plans were, it would make it hard for him to be flexible, And it was that sort of just the way he looked at the world. He didn't explain his actions in terms that conventional economists could understand, let alone ordinary people. Mr. Bernanke comes from a different tradition which prizes what's known as transparency, that everybody should know what the Fed is thinking and doing because it'll make the economy operate more smoothly. He also has a gift of explaining things, comes from years of being a teacher at Princeton, I think. And so that's the personality difference. But the times are different as well. Mr. Greenspan presided over a Fed that was seen as invincible. Nobody in Congress dared to criticize the Fed, or the few people who did were widely regarded as cranks. Mr. Bernanke is now presiding over a Fed which has become quite unpopular. People are suspicious of the bailouts. How come they can create trillions of dollars to take care of Wall Street, and we still have all these people being foreclosed on and unemployed? And so part of the reason he's gone more public is to defend the Fed so that he can protect its independence and its political viability as an independent central bank in a democratic government.
Quite suddenly, and you sort of alluded to this earlier, he did this about-face in early 2008 when the stock markets in Europe and Asia took a nosedive. Can you talk about how very surprising his response was to those who'd become accustomed to that sort of consensus approach?
Well, I think what happened there was that there's a lot to be said for reaching consensus inside the Fed, and Mr. Bernanke was pretty good at that. I think that must also come from years of presiding over the Princeton Economics Department. But it does tend to mean that you take longer to make a decision, and that sometimes is not the best thing for monetary policy. So I think that I know that at the end of 2007, he realized the Fed was behind the curve, that the economy was worse than they had anticipated, and he would like to cut rates. But he kind of waited. He wanted to wait until the regularly scheduled meeting of the Fed in order to do that, because that made it seem like the committee was doing it. But the economy deteriorated more sharply than he anticipated, and then there was, around Martin Luther King Day in January 2008, a scare in the markets. It turned out to be something of a false alarm. And that's when he basically called the committee together and said, I want to cut interest rates by 0.75 percentage point today, and I want to do it again in about a week. And that really was a turning point. It's one where he took command and didn't wait for consensus.
David Wessel is my guest. He's economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. His book is called In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. Even among Bernanke's champions, there are many who say unequivocally that he was too slow to respond to the economic crisis as it was mounting in the early part of his tenure. What do you think kept him from, if not recognizing what was about to happen, from acting accordingly earlier?
I think it was recognizing it. He didn't appreciate just how severe this was. Mr. Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, who was his sidekick through most of this period, described the housing mess as being contained. And that, by that they meant they knew they had a housing problem, they knew it was going to hurt the economy, but they figured that the rest of the economy, and in particular the rest of the world, would be strong enough to prevent this from being a major economic calamity in the United States. They were wrong. They just didn't see how interconnected all this housing investment was with the financial system. So I think the main thing was they were caught by surprise. Now, there was a certain amount of the Fed is always driving the car looking in the rearview mirror. All the economic statistics we get tell us about something that happened already, and very few tell us about something that is happening right now, and even fewer are reliable guides to the future. Where what a Federal Reserve chairman gets paid for is to have that sixth sense that says, you know, something's a little weird here and I want to get ahead of it. And Mr. Bernanke just didn't get it right away. But once he got it, he moved with extraordinary speed and aggressiveness and I think succeeded.
What played into the timing in terms of his appearance before Congress last October to ask for what ultimately became that $700 billion bailout package?
Well, Mr. Bernanke for some time before then had understood that we needed taxpayer money in the banking system in order to prevent the banking system from collapsing and hurting the real economy. It is something that previous financial crises have demonstrated, both in the United States and in other countries, that when the banking system gets into trouble, in the end, the taxpayers are going to have to step in order to save the financial system and for the rest of us. Not for their sake, but for the rest of the economy. The politics were very dicey, though. Congress was sort of resistant to this, to say the least. It was an election year. Mr. Bernanke and Mr. Paulson decided that going to Congress simply wouldn't have been successful, and that getting rejected from Congress would have been worse than asking in the first place. Although, on the last point, Mr. Bernanke expressed some second thoughts about that. Bear Stearns goes under in March. The Fed comes up with $30 billion to prevent it from going into bankruptcy, but then they don't go to Congress. Then we get to September 2008, and that's when the crisis goes from horrendous to disastrous, or whatever the right adverb is. We have in one weekend Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, and the insurance company AIG all on the verge of collapse. They sell Merrill Lynch to Bank of America. They don't save Lehman Brothers. It goes into bankruptcy. They expect some ripples. They get a tsunami. And they spend $85 billion of money to prevent AIG from following Lehman into bankruptcy. At that point, Mr. Bernanke says, we just cannot wait any longer. We need taxpayer money. I can't continue to print money at the Fed to bail out the banking system. He and Mr. Paulson go arm in arm to Congress and tell them, to the congressman's great shock, we are on the edge of another Great Depression. We need $700 billion of taxpayer money, and we basically need a no-strings deal. And as you may remember, initially the House voted it down, which was quite an unsettling event, but eventually they gave him the money, and eventually the money was used by Mr. Paulson for exactly the way that Mr. Bernanke had intended, to invest in the bank's capital rather than buying assets from the banks.
I guess it was helpful that he had not been known for hyperbolic language in the past. This was an unprecedented announcement before Congress.
Absolutely. The members of Congress who were at that meeting came away extraordinarily shaken. They had known Mr. Bernanke as almost timid, introverted, so cautious in his prose that it was sometimes boring to listen to him. Mr. Paulson, on the other hand, was a very energetic speaker and tended to use slang and had a kind of locker room affect that, you know, he was always excited. But Mr. Bernanke really wasn't. And so when he came to them, and Mr. Paulson was quite skillful and deliberate in letting Bernanke give him the bad news, when he came to them and said, look, this is really not something that you can opt not to do. This is something you have to do for the good of the country. And you, the 14 or 18 congressmen in this room, you have it in your power to prevent another Great Depression. I've done everything I can. I now need your help. And that really shook them up. Now, it took a while for them to get the rest of the members of Congress to go along. But in the end, that turned out to be a very important bit of credibility. That's why it's so important to have a Fed chairman who people respect. Because, you know, every once in a while, you really do need to get the bad news directly and to know that this isn't just a talking point and you can't debate it for 6 months.
He was also around this time pressuring Bank of America to keep its pledge to buy Merrill Lynch, even after it became quite apparent that Merrill was in far worse shape than previously
right.
believed. Can you give us some perspective on just how unusual that sort of action is?
Well, you know, this is a series of unusual actions, any one of which would be worthy of study, and we would be writing books and series about, and we have like dozens of them. I mean, just think about it. There was not only that one, but there was Bear Stearns, there's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, there's Lehman Brothers, there's AIG. The thing about Bank of America and Merrill Lynch was that Paulson and Bernanke thought this was one thing that had gone well. They'd managed to do a deal or get Bank of America to do a deal to buy Merrill Lynch without any taxpayer money. So they thought this was a box that had been checked. And Bank of America took the deal to their shareholders. The people voted for it. And then in December 2008, Ken Lewis, the CEO of Bank of America, starts to get cold feet because he realizes that Merrill Lynch is really in a lot worse shape than he thought.
Let me have you pause there, David, and we will resume this
okay.
after our break. David Wessel is economics editor of The Wall Street Journal and the author of In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. We'll be back after the break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is economics editor of the Wall Street Journal, David Wessel. His new book is called In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So as you were telling us before the break, David, Ken Lewis, the head of Bank of America, had sort of green-lighted this deal in a very short amount of time as compared with any other sort of multi-billion dollar transaction that he might take on.
Well, that's true, but that's the story of this crisis. Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan did the deal for Bear Stearns with a lot of speed as well. It was, to answer your question quite bluntly, it was extraordinarily unusual for the Treasury Secretary of the United States and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve to basically be muscling the CEO of a big bank and say, you better close this deal, because if you don't, the world's going to fall apart. They did not believe that the financial system was strong enough to withstand a shock like Merrill Lynch being revealed to be so weak the Bank of America didn't want to touch him. And they also, as they told Mr. Lewis, thought it would make Bank of America look like a poorly managed institution. It would hurt confidence in Bank of America. And they thought then we'll have two messes on our hands, Bank of America and Merrill Lynch. They put a lot of pressure on him. It came out in a strange way because of the New York Attorney General's investigation of bonuses, and then it produced an orgy of emails, which made great reading for voyeuristic journalists like me, but God, it made me a lot more careful about what I say on my BlackBerry after that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. We have an email here from Sam who writes, the test for whether Bernanke has learned his lesson is whether he runs the economy at its potential growth rate of approximately 2.5 to 3% after the recovery takes hold and not at an arbitrary inflation target of 1 to 2%. Do you agree?
Well, I think I disagree. Look, the test for Mr. Bernanke is, can he get monetary policy right so that we have an economy growing at its potential, which means in a rate of growth which doesn't produce inflation above the target he has set, which is roughly 2%. It's a very tricky thing. It's always hard to steer the economy, but it's particularly hard at a time when we've been through such an unusual period and we're not quite sure whether the economy is working the same way it did before the crisis. That's the job he has, to try and do what the questioner says.
What sort of relationship does a Fed chairman historically typically have with the White House?
Well, that's a good question, and the reason I hesitate is, in the not-too-distant past, the president felt free to pressure the Fed chairman. Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, even the first George Bush tried to pressure the Fed chairman to run interest rates a little lower because it was good for the economy in the short term and good for re-election of the incumbents. But President Clinton and the second President Bush adopted a real hands-off policy, and President Obama has followed, where they may have a lot of conversations, and they certainly work incredibly closely together on things like the financial rescue and the repair plan that they're trying to put together, but they treat the Fed as independent and try to leave it alone on monetary policy. And the reason for that is, simply, conventional wisdom now is that in a democracy, the politicians will always prefer a little more growth now at the expense of a little more inflation later, and that economies do better if we let the Fed have the long-term view. It's actually one that Larry Summers, the president's economic advisor, wrote about as an academic. It's going to be a really interesting test now, though, that Mr. Bernanke has worked so closely with the Bush and Obama administrations. Now that he's going to get another term, and at some point he's going to have to start raising interest rates and tightening credit, and he's probably going to do that before the political system thinks it's wise and before most Americans think the economy is healthy. So it'll be interesting to see whether Mr. Obama has the self-discipline or even chooses to keep his mouth shut, or maybe he'll criticize Mr. Bernanke.
Of course, there were a lot of people who expected that the president would install Larry Summers as Fed chairman. What kind of calculus do you think took place within the Obama administration, besides the apparent upward movement of the economy, to decide that, in fact, Bernanke should stay in place?
Well, I think that at the beginning of the president's term, there was widespread speculation that Mr. Summers was a Fed chairman in waiting, but as time went on, the odds seemed to shift in favor of reappointment. So by the time it came, it was not a surprise to the markets, and we had written about it and stuff like that. I think what went on in the administration was actually fairly simple and straightforward. You know, sometimes this stuff is not as complicated as people think. Changing drivers when the road remained so bumpy and curvy just was seen as too risky, and that any time you change Fed chairman, you go through a period of uncertainty, and Lord knows we have plenty of that in the economy now. We don't need more. Secondly, the United States really has to worry about what foreign creditors think, the Chinese and others who lend us lots of money. And even if Mr. Obama's choice would have been independent and just as determined to fight inflation as Mr. Bernanke is, people might not have believed that until he proved it or she proved it. And that could have meant another period of higher interest rates or a weaker dollar as people sort of tested the new Fed chairman. And finally, it always depends on what the choices are. And it looks like Mr. Obama decided that Mr. Bernanke's particular mix of personality and consensus and intelligence and courage was simply better than what was offered by the alternatives, including Larry Summers, who's known for being very, very smart, but not always so easy to get along with.
David Wessel is with us. He's economics editor of The Wall Street Journal and the author of a new book called In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. If you want to ask a question or join the conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email. That goes to think@kera.org. Let's talk for a minute about the sort of psychological effect, if any, that the president's announcement this week has had on the economy. Things are starting to look up. Obviously, the timing is not accidental.
I think that one reason that the president announced the Bernanke decision today or yesterday was that he's in the process of trying to declare victory against the recession. He doesn't want to overpromise. He's made all the caveats about how unemployment's going to remain high and we're not out of this yet and all that. But basically, they want to take advantage, take credit of the fact that the economy is looking a little better. So one way to do that is to not change generals. It's hard to argue everything's going great, and they say, but we have to replace the Fed chairman. Another thing you can do is sort of punctuate the crisis. Say that, look, the coast is clear now a little bit, and so I'm putting Bernanke in place for another 4 years, remove that uncertainty. And so I think it did have an important psychological effect. It also deflected a lot of attention from other problems like the federal deficit and the healthcare mess and stuff like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Are we in danger at this point of letting our guard down too soon on the economy?
Yes. Look, that's the thing that's tricky here. If things start to look good for a while and everybody breathes a sigh of relief, Wall Street goes back to its bad old ways, Congress decides to rein in the stimulus, the Fed moves too quickly to raise interest rates, we could just provoke another recession. That's what happened in 1937. We were pretty much on our way out of the Depression. Everybody reacted too soon, and then we went back and had a second chapter in it. It's something that Mr. Bernanke and the president's economic advisors talk about, so they're aware of it. So there's actually, you could go too long with this extraordinary credit and get inflation, or you could pull back too soon and get another recession. It's not going to be easy.
What sort of pressure is on him right now to start pulling back some of this federal capital that has sort of flooded the market?
Well, you know, when you have a crisis, when the banks are toppling, people tend to give you the benefit of the doubt. When things get better, they start to ask a lot of hard questions, like, did Goldman Sachs get bailed out here by the way you did AIG? Was that right? Are you giving too much money to the bankers, and is it more than they need to save the system? Are you creating the seeds of tomorrow's inflation by leaving so much credit in the economy? So there are all sorts of tough questions to get asked, and I think that the Fed's new prominence as a result of the crisis has made a lot more people aware of its power. So in one respect, the most significant challenge that Mr. Bernanke faces over the next 4 years is to protect the Fed from political assaults, not only political pressure, but from political assaults that could weaken his ability and the ability of his subsequent Fed chairman to do their jobs.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We will go now to Brett in Louisville. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Chris. Great show. I am very curious about this. I've always wondered how and when the Fed became basically so powerful that they really don't have much oversight from Congress, and if that's always been the case or if it's just kind of developed over the past few years. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
That's a good question, and the short answer is it's always been the case. The Fed was created in 1913 in response to an earlier financial panic, and it was set up as a kind of strange hybrid between private banks and the government. it was even more autonomous then. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York basically ran the show, and the people who ran that were barely government appointees. In the 30s, after the mess of the Great Depression, they changed the system, and they made the Federal Reserve Board in Washington the center of power. And those are people who are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and they do have to report to Congress periodically, and Congress could change the law. But they have not always been so independent of the government. Until 1951, they basically cut a deal with the federal government to keep interest rates on Treasury borrowing low. But basically, since the 50s, and then particularly after Paul Volcker broke the back of inflation in the 80s, they have become increasingly independent. And in this crisis, they showed just how much power they had. It's what led me to call them, in the subtitle of my book, the fourth branch of government. They are subject to congressional oversight, and Congress could, if it wanted, change the law and weaken their independence. So far, it shows very little inclination to do that.
Do you think it's appropriate that we have this sort of shadow fourth branch of the government?
I think it makes a lot of sense to have an independent central bank when it comes to setting monetary policy and fighting inflation, because politicians do tend to be short-sighted, and you need somebody to take the long view. I think the tougher question is in all this financial rescue stuff, and it's quite interesting that the Fed is using powers that was granted in the 30s to lend in, quote, unusual and exigent circumstances, which a phrase that gets defined. It can lend to almost anybody. And it's quite interesting that in the president's proposal to reform the financial system, one change he would make is to say, well, they can still make those loans, but they have to get the formal okay of the Secretary of the Treasury before they do that. And that does seem to me to be appropriate, that when they start doing this extraordinary stuff, spending, in effect, indirectly taxpayer money, it does seem that the representatives of the taxpayers should have some say in that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. David Wessel is with us talking about his new book, In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. And the second subtitle is, of course, How the Federal Reserve Became the Fourth Branch of Government. We will go next to Richardson, and we'll speak with Ron. Hi, Ron.
Well, hi. Thank you very much. Excellent show. My question, which is kind of a little bit more specific, is that on the bailout of AIG, the top two recipients were foreign banks. I believe one of them was Deutsche Bank. And I'm just stunned that the U.S., and I emphasize U.S. Federal Reserve, bailed out two foreign banks to the tune of billions, tens of billions of dollars with taxpayer money. And I don't recall or have seen any efforts of compensation being paid by Germany and the home countries of those banks. I understand the necessity of perhaps averting financial collapse, it would seem to me that we should be presenting these people with at least a bill for bailing out their banks. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, David?
Well, it is a fact that the world financial system is amazingly integrated now, and that Lehman Brothers as well, is a wonderful example of how complicated that is. So we have these global financial institutions, but we have national central banks and national regulators. And there isn't any system we have for going around and saying to the Germans, your share of the AIG bailout is XYZ, but by the same token, they aren't sending us the bill for the fact that their banks lost a ton on U.S. subprime real estate. Where the system could be changed, and where there are proposals to change it, is had we had a different law, the government might have had a way to take over AIG or a Lehman Brothers the same way they would take over a bank and sort of not pay off all the creditors all the money that was owed them. But because there wasn't a law like that, they really only had, in their view, two choices. One, let them go bankrupt. They tried that with Lehman Brothers, and it was a disaster. And the other is to bail out the creditors, because if you don't have a system for deciding who gets paid off and who not, you're in trouble. If we start nailing the Deutsche Bank, then the next day they're going to start nailing Bank of America and Citicorp, and that's the kind of tit-for-tat thing that's not very helpful in the middle of a financial panic.
Does the fact that some institutions were allowed to fail and others were bailed out leave these major corporations with enough of a sense of ongoing risk in the future that they will not perhaps make the kind of bad moves that they've made in the past, assuming that there might be a big federal bailout at the end of it?
It's a big problem. If the Fed and the Treasury create the impression that if you're big and you get into trouble, we will come rescue you, we might fire the management, we might take a whack out of the shareholders, but we will pay off all the people who lent you money, it will encourage excessive risk-taking, and the people who lend won't be very careful. And that's a bad thing, and that's something that Mr. Bernanke says he wants to avoid. At the moment, the proposal for avoiding it is to give the Fed more authority over these very big and complicated and interconnected institutions, and to create a set of rules which require them to have more capital than other banks, which is a way to say their cushions would be bigger in case of a crisis, and it would tend to make them less profitable. It remains to be seen whether, A, Congress will go along with that, and B, whether that's enough to get rid of this hazard. Because the Fed can't unring a bell. Everybody knows now that in a crisis, the Fed will do extraordinary things that until March 2008, we never thought they'd do.
Do you think that many of the precedents that have been set during the Bernanke term will, in fact, last, or are these sort of one-shot deals?
You can't make these things one-shot deal. In the past, my colleagues and I would write that there is a law that says that the Fed could lend to almost anybody in a crisis. It takes the vote of 5 of the 7 members of the Federal Reserve Board, and it's never been used since the Great Depression. And so we would use that to bat off these rumors we'd hear that they're about to lend to Chrysler or they're going to lend to the city of New York and stuff. But in the future, when we're confronted with these rumors of these bad situations, we'll have to say, well, they don't like to do it, but in fact, they lent for Bear Stearns and they lent for AIG.
David Wessel is with us. He is economics editor of The Wall Street Journal. His newest book is called In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Pulitzer Prize winner David Wessel is my guest this hour. He's economics editor for the Wall Street Journal and the author of a book called In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. If you want to be part of the discussion, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
We have a system that's free of political influence, which is the court system. And yet the Fed is completely privatized. And if we were to turn the courts over to the ACLU or the Fortune 500 companies, that might be similar. But it seems that everything that the Fed actually does, like or affects, like the printing of money, is done by the Treasury. We leave them all the booty. And it seems that belongs to the Treasury and the taxpayers. And, you know, they've loaned out $2.3 trillion in our name. It seems we ought to get the upside of that, not just the cost.
I don't think it's correct to say that the Fed is completely privatized. The Fed is created by the government. The Federal Reserve Board in Washington has an enormous amount of power. Those are government employees nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. It is true that the Fed is a hybrid, and there are 12 Federal Reserve banks out there. Those banks are technically owned by the local bankers, and the local bankers elect 6 of the 9 members of each of their boards. Although those boards have relatively limited powers, they are involved in picking the presidents of the Federal Reserve banks. So it's unusual. It's something of an anomaly, and I suspect it'll be changed as all of this. But I think there's a myth out there that the Fed is somehow a shareholder-owned corporation owned by the big banks, and that reflects the historical antecedents of the Fed and some technicalities about the Federal Reserve banks, but it really is a public agency. but it's independent. Its independence is not guaranteed by the Constitution the way the courts are, but it is the current belief in among elected politicians that we ought to let them do their thing without too much interference, or else we'll get more inflation than we want. It's not universally held. There's some members of Congress who want to change that, but that's sort of been the deal.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak next with Jesse in Dallas. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing? I was wanting to ask you and the guest if you guys think Ron Paul's Audit the Fed bill has any chance of going through, and how we could live in a state where we don't have anybody auditing the Fed.
So Ron Paul is a congressman from Texas, a Republican, who has a book coming out himself called End the Fed, and he basically would like to get rid of the Federal Reserve. He has a bill which has attracted the support of more than half the members of the House that would expand the auditing abilities of the Government Accountability Office, an arm of Congress, to audit the Fed. It's not true that the GAO doesn't have the power to audit the Fed. The GAO audits some parts of the Fed, including all the money they're spending on Bear Stearns and AIG and so forth like that, and their banking operations. But the Congress in the 1970s protected from GAO audit the monetary policy function, the question of interest rates, of printing money, of making deals with foreign central banks. Mr. Paul's bill would end that thing. Mr. Bernanke argues that that would basically lead to Congress second-guessing and eventually trying to control their decisions on interest rates, and he's against it. It looks to me like a lot of the people who supported the Ron Paul bill didn't understand exactly what it would do, and that Mr. Bernanke has persuaded enough of them that this is not a good idea, that the bill, as Ron Paul proposes it, is unlikely to pass. But the sentiment that Ron Paul conveys and the widespread belief that the Fed is just too secretive has already made an impact, and the Fed is, you know, rushing to try and figure out how they can get out from under this thing, and they're going to be more transparent, and I suspect that some version of the Ron Paul bill will pass that will make for more audits of the Fed, but it will still protect this core function, the monetary policy interest rate setting function, from oversight by the GAO. Although the chairman of the Fed will still have to come and explain what he does, they won't be subject to the GAO auditors coming in and asking a lot of questions about how and why they made the decisions.
David Wessel is my guest. We'll go next on the phone to Denton, where we'll speak with Doug. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I'm reading the guest book, and I'm enjoying it very much, and I had a question to follow up to his comment that these loans that he's making are indirectly the taxpayers' money. And I was wondering, did he mean by that by making these loans and issuing new dollars at the Fed?
I understand the question.
Okay.
I guess he got cut off. It's not what I meant. What I meant was that the Fed makes a profit every year. And it makes a profit because it trades in Treasury bills. It buys them and sells them, and it usually ends up getting interest on the Treasury bills from the rest of the government or from just selling them for more than it paid for them. At the end of the year, it pays its expenses. It doesn't have to go to Congress for an appropriation. It's self-financing in that sense. And it gives any money left over to the Treasury. If it loses money on Bear Stearns, if it loses money on AIG, or it loses money on any one of the other dozen loan programs that's undertaken during this crisis, then it will give less money to the Treasury. And so to that extent, they're playing with our money.
How will the Fed begin to divest itself of these investments that it's made in struggling and failing corporations?
Well, that's a good question. The easier thing to get rid of is the Treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities that it's bought. Either it can sell them or it can hold on to them until they mature and then just not buy new ones. That's the relatively easy one. It's having a heck of a time getting out from under the AIG loans. That's the biggest mess they've got. And it's probably going to take years for that to unwind. They just have to wait until the company can sell off some of the securities it has and pay back the loan. It's paid back some of the money, but not all of it. The Fed would very much like to cut a deal with the Treasury and say, here, you take over these things and they put these on your books, but there's no sign that the Treasury wants that to happen.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next on the phone to Plano and speak with Shay. Hello, Shay.
Hi. My question is, by the way, it's a great program. Thank you. My question is, help me understand why it would not have been a good idea, instead of paying all the banks the money that was paid to them to bail them out, that that money would have been paid to individuals who couldn't make their mortgages because of the bad loans, and save the individuals so they could still have the money to spend and help the society, and the banks would have, by getting paid the mortgages, would have stayed solvent. I'd really like to understand why it wasn't done that way, and what's the argument against it.
I don't think it's an either-or situation. So when a bank gets into trouble, sometimes the reason it gets into trouble is that it owns things that aren't worth what it paid for them, or it has made a loan and the person has been unable to pay the loan and the bank has gotten the collateral. Now, sometimes the collateral is a house, a mortgage like the caller suggests. Sometimes it's security. In many cases, it was these very complicated securities that represented a fraction of a mortgage on millions of or thousands of homes or commercial real estate. So in order to prevent the bank from collapsing, the authorities decided that they had to sort of protect the bank, because if you went through and dealt with each loan one at a time, we'd all be dead before they sorted it out. But there is another question here, which is, why didn't the government do more to prevent foreclosures? That would have been good for the people in the houses, would have been good for their neighbors, and would have made things better, the caller's absolutely right, for the banks that were holding on to mortgages or mortgage-related securities. And there was an argument about that during the Bush administration, and actually Mr. Bernanke was in favor of more aggressive action on foreclosures. It was another lesson he drew from the Great Depression. But the Treasury, both then and to some extent now, felt that it was just too expensive and that it would have meant rewarding too many people who would otherwise have paid their mortgages, and so they're still struggling to come up with the right balance.
What are the most important places to watch to see that the credit markets are really loosening up in a way that makes true sense for the economy?
If you're a doctor and you're looking at a patient's blood tests and everything, there's going to be a lot of measures that the doctors watch that they use all this shorthand to describe, and it's hard for us to understand. But in the financial markets, one of the most important measures is the one that gauges how much banks are charging each other for lending to each other. Because during the crisis, one of the things that happened was the rates they charged each other went through the ceiling. They were so nervous they didn't even trust each other. And that thing is called a spread, because people usually look at the rates that they charge each other compared to the rates that the government has to pay to borrow, widened a lot and has now come down quite a bit. So that's one really good thing to watch. A second thing to watch, of course, is how much lending the banks are actually doing. It's a little complicated, but we're not going to get beyond this thing until the banks stop hoarding money and start lending more. And then, of course, to some extent, one of the easiest things to watch is the stock market. It's not a perfect measure, but when things are better in the financial markets and banks, stocks do tend to go up.
Is it just as important that U.S. Sort of individual investors and consumers might have been chastened by what's happened over the past couple of years as corporations, or are corporations still sort of the leaders in terms of how our economy plays out?
Well, I think you have to divide corporations into two categories. The corporations that make things, Caterpillars, General Motors, General Electric, to the extent that it makes things, and it's not in the finance business, they weren't so highly leveraged. They made some mistakes, but they weren't the ones that created this crisis. The crisis was created in the financial institutions, and it's a very good question whether they've learned their lesson or not. I've been surprised by the extent to which some of them seem to be returning to their old ways, and it suggests a kind of sigh of relief, well, that's over, now we can go back to doing things. I think the government is going to try and prevent that from happening. Consumers, for now, do seem to be quite chastened. Americans were saving next to nothing before the crisis, and now they're saving quite a bit. It's one of the reasons why consumer spending is so weak, and that's hurting the economy. Everybody agrees that in the long run, consumers need to save more. American households didn't save enough. And this may be, we may look back on this, that this was a significant moment in changing Americans' behavior.
Let's go next on the phones to Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes. What gets me is in the 1980s, there was a gentleman by the name of Mike Milken, and he created what was known as the junk bond. And he made, what was it, something like $500 million a year in bonuses. He was the highest paid anywhere. Anyway, he turned around and he created the junk bond. And everything started falling apart in the market. And he went to prison. Now, today, we have our wonderful banks. And they have created subprime loans, derivatives, what is it, the securitized mortgages, collateralized bonds. And they say, oh, well, we're not going to prosecute anybody. And the purpose of these derivatives and so forth were not for you and me, but they were like bookies placing off their bets.
What do you think about that, David?
Well, I agree with a lot of what he just said. I don't think Milken went to jail for creating junk bonds. He went to jail for cheating and for breaking the rules. And it is surprising that there haven't been more prosecutions. There's some investigations underway, but I think that the caller reflects kind of this widespread sense in the country that, well, this wasn't all just a whole bunch of innocent people who made some mistakes. There was a lot of fraud here. There were a lot of people who were doing one thing and saying another. And the authorities haven't seemed to have found a way to nail them yet. And it's a good question. There are some investigations ongoing, but there haven't been any high-profile prosecutions yet, like there were in the Milken era or even in the earlier corporate scandals. And I expect until that happens, people are going to be saying, you know, who are the villains here and why aren't they being punished? One problem, though, is that it wasn't just a few bad apples. The whole system was rotten. Every check and balance in the system failed. Every risk management committee, the credit rating agencies, the regulators. And so even if we get the satisfaction of seeing a couple of people go to jail, we have to know that there are a lot of other people who allowed this to happen.
David, you've been on this beat for some time now. How long do you think we need to wait before we can really accurately assess the impact of Bernanke's specific response to the meltdown?
I think we have several years. It's kind of like the middle of a football game, and we're at the half, and so far so good. We had a terrible situation, and he figured out how to get us out of it so that we didn't tumble into the abyss of another Great Depression. But now we have the second half. It has to do with getting the economy on its feet again. It has to do with avoiding inflation. It has to do with setting up a system which is less prone to these catastrophes in the future. And those events haven't transpired yet, so we don't even have the benefit of real-time analysis. We have to wait for them to happen before we can start second-guessing him. But I'm prepared to do it on a daily basis.
David Wessel is the Pulitzer Prize-winning economics editor of The Wall Street Journal. His new book is called In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. David, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.